Cassini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 225th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 224 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you will also find links to my online newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world. Articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it. It's the weekly paper. Subscribe, and you'll only get one email per week. I was the featured poet at Poetry at the Old Putt the last week, February 21st, anyhow, 2 weeks ago, at the wonderful Freight House in Mayapack. The building is actually the Freight House for the Mayapack Station on the now-defunct Putnam Railroad line. It's a terrific venue. My reading was followed by an open mic, which only comfortably holds together 25 people in the place, but it was packed. There will be the book put together shortly from the readings, both mine and the open mics. Those interested should email me at www.johnmack13@gmail.com. The cafe is a terrific place to drop in for a cup and a snack. It is located at 609 Route 6 in Mayapack, behind the music store, and serve light food, coffee, tea, hot chocolate, wine, beer, and martinis. Call 845-628-1872 for information. That's 845-628-1872. And if you go, tell them I sent you. A personal note. Today is Today is the 68th anniversary of my father's death. He, a New York City police officer, died in a tragic accident at the age of 46. Although I had little time to spend with him, his generosity and sense of humor loom large in my memory today. But I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live, or as most do, listens later. The recordings are archived at the website I mentioned, and notifications of the most recent shows are sent out weekly by email. We had no show last week due to the massive power failure in the Hudson Valley. Then my interview with poet Ace Mulvihill will have to be rescheduled and will impact some of the other scheduling. But now to the 225th in the series, callers may call in at any time during the show by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to nib the conclusion of my interview with my guests. My guest tonight is longtime CBS reporter Steve Futterman. Steve has covered many stories of every stripe during his 20-year tenure at CBS, sports, war, natural disasters, politics, and mass shootings. We'll get into all of these during our discussion this evening. Good evening, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Sorry I'm a bit late. Have to admit I had some cell phone trouble, but I'm with you now. We're connected.
Terrific. I've sent you some basic instructions on Facebook. I don't know if you saw them. I know the reporting takes you all over the world, such as the recent Olympics. Where is your normal home base?
I'm normally based in Los Angeles, where I am at right now. I sometimes joke with people. They say, where will you be tomorrow? I'll say, I'm visiting Los Angeles. The work comes, you know, sometimes in peaks and valleys. Sometimes I'm on the road quite a bit continuously. A lot will depend what year it is. An election year, I'm on the road a lot more than a non-election year. But it just varies. You can never predict where you're going to be. And that's one of the things I happen to like about it. That's some things that other people may not enjoy about it, but I do enjoy the fact that you just never know where you'll be really the next day sometimes in this job.
Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up here in Los Angeles. Many of my colleagues think I'm so amped up. They think I'm a New Yorker. I do love New York, but I've never lived there on a regular basis. But grew up in Los Angeles, went to school in the – I was actually a Valley boy. Remember the Frank Zappa hit Valley Girl? I was a Valley boy. Grew up in the San Fernando Valley and always interested in journalism, always wanted to be a journalist from – really, I think from the time I was maybe 7, 8 years old, I think that early on, the news business fascinated me. And I'm lucky enough to have been able to do what I wanted to do from the time I was a kid.
I had that interest, too. And it took me away and then took me back to column writing in my field. But it's always fascinated me also. And my oldest friend was Newsweek Saigon presence during the war, so I did have some relation to the industry, and I met many through him. So I imagine you went to high school there. When was your first writing or your first television experience?
Well, for real, I mean, obviously as a child, I had my own little. A home publication that was read by me and maybe a friend and maybe one of my parents. I had like a little newspaper I would do once in a while on my own. I would read the LA Times. I actually used to remember getting up in the morning on a big news event. I would run out to the driveway and try to get the newspaper when it, you know, right when it was delivered. I wanted to see what the headline was. I wanted to see what the story was going to be about. And I was just, you know, enamored by this whole concept of breaking news. Would watch the breaking news on TV, would read it in the newspaper. But we worked on the junior high school newspaper, the high school newspaper, and it just led to what I've ended up doing.
How did you actually break into commercial journalism?
I was a stringer for a number of years. I did stringing for anyone who would take me, which is what the life is sometimes. And that's sort of where I learned my craft, learned by doing to some extent. Obviously, I went to school and took the journalism classes. But I always, for me, it seemed to be learning by doing was the best test for me. And I got breaks here and there. I would do some freelance work for this network, that network. And then finally I hooked on with Mutual NBC full-time in the late 1980s and then switched to CBS around 10 years after that.
So I was always thought that NBC and Mutual were two separate networks. Did they merge the radio end or the television end at some time?
What happened was NBC decided to get out of the radio business, and they sold their brand, their name, to Westwood One, which also owned the Mutual network. And Westwood One then marketed it with certain, there were certain restrictions, certain allowances. NBC reporters were on NBC radio constantly, but there were some certain designations, what you could do, what you couldn't do, but we were NBC radio.
Westwood One has really made its name in the New York area as the sports network. That's a rival carrying all the games to ESPN. Do they still have the news organization as well as the sports?
They don't have the NBC or the Mutual organization. They still have an unbranded news organization. In other words, they offer their news department to stations without a Westwood One brand. It's sort of a generic type newscast, which a number of independent stations will pick up. But I think they are best known as a sports network. They have the Super Bowl. They have the NFL contract. They have the NCAA contract. They have the Masters contract. They had the Olympics in Pyeongchang. Like many other players in the news field, they are running into some financial issues right now. The company that owns Westwood One, Cumulus, has, I believe, gone into some type of protection, maybe bankruptcy, maybe not, but some type of financial protection. So, you know, there are many radio networks that are having some tough times right now.
What brought you to CBS?
The offer, the job opportunity. And I felt, CBS to me was always the gold standard as far as commercial radio, and I would even say radio overall for the top of the hour newscast. I always felt the CBS newscast was the best, and always had sort of a yearning like maybe one day I could get to work for them. And when the opportunity came, I jumped immediately.
When I was very young, and maybe I'm only remembering this because I think I should remember it, but I heard "This is Ed Murrow" from London, you know, and that was obviously the beginning of CBS radio for me. What were your first CBS assignments?
Always have been breaking news assignments. One of the first opportunities I got was actually that really put me into a good situation with CBS was I was sent to cover election night. Probably a 2-3 day assignment in 2000 in Austin, Texas, to cover George W. Bush. And that assignment ended up lasting around 2 months. More or less stayed in Austin for the duration. And as that saga continued, I was there and was really able to get my feet wet and sort of allow myself to really have the people at CBS trust me completely. Before that, though, I actually, one of my very early assignments for CBS, I think would have been 2 years earlier, happened to be in St. Louis when a guy named Mark McGuire was trying to break Roger Maris's record. And
sure.
I was there, and my colleague Dan Revive, who I'm sure you know, was there as well. Dan had to get back to Washington because his son was starting school, I think in high school, later that week. And I remember mentioning to Dan, keep him out of high school. You know, let him stay here for the McGuire theatrics and the event. And Dan was a bit more responsible than I was. And he said, no, we have to get back to school. And Dan said, it'll be good for you to cover this. And sure enough, the next night, McGuire breaks Maris's record. I'm the top story on the CBS network for a number of hours. That was another moment for me where I was able to show the network that I was able to do the job that they wanted me to do.
Going off on the tangent before we get into many of your major stories, do you have any feelings on McGuire's and the controversy about his belonging in the Baseball Hall of Fame?
It's a tough one. I mean, he did. I've always said, even if you are, let's assume that McGuire and Bonds are guilty of what people say they are guilty of. taking steroids, taking banned substances. You could give me all of those banned substances tenfold. I still could not hit one home run. There is an innate ability that these guys have ahead of time. And you look at especially Bonds. You look at Bonds' record before his alleged use of steroids and performance-enhancing drugs. He was a Hall of Famer even before he allegedly started using these things. He was a great player. McGuire had a good career, but Bonds had a great career before the alleged use began. It's hard to say what to do. There are many people who are in the Hall of Fame, purists, who say if you used it, you should not be in the Hall of Fame at all. And that seems to be what the voters are going with right now. Bonds, I believe, is getting more votes each year, but he's not close to entering the Hall of Fame.
They say that it will not help you hit a baseball or it will not help you throw a curveball, but it will give you either more strength or more velocity into where it goes or to how fast it goes. But I don't know how true that is.
No, I think it is true. I mean, you look at Bonds' record before the alleged use began. He hit home runs, but not as many. Also, the other thing that the performance-enhancing drugs supposedly help you with, and doctors will tell you they're convinced of this, it's medically proven, it helps in recovery. It helps in the recovery. Every game you play, there's a bit of wear and tear. If you're taking the steroids, you can recover quicker. You'll be a better player the next day compared to someone who didn't take it and has a bit of that wear and tear. Obviously, for a major injury, it really can help.
That was Andy Pettit's claim, that the only reason he took it was to recover because he was having a hard time. Yeah. You've also covered many major stories, though. Let's talk about some of them. You covered the tenements Square uprising. Now, number one, was it the language barrier? And what was the government reaction there to the American journalists? Was it a difficult assignment?
No, it was actually very easy. For some reason, they, if you recall way back, this is 1989, June 4th is the famous day that the tanks came into Tiananmen Square. In fact, in China now, the term 6-4, which my Chinese is not very good. I'll say it as I try to say it properly in Chinese. Liu Si. That is 6-4, the way I pronounce it in Chinese. That is a term that many people know. When you say that, you're talking about Tiananmen Square. But that was a very interesting time. I did not get there at the beginning. Remember, it began with a visit by the head of the Soviet Union at that time. That's when the students felt they could take advantage of the situation. There would be lots of media coverage, and that's when they started their protests in Tiananmen Square. The government, after days and days of embarrassing coverage of this, basically cut off the satellite. So you couldn't go live, but you could go on the air. So you had what they called pigeons, producers, this on the TV side, people who would take your stories from Beijing to Hong Kong and just broadcast them there. You couldn't go live on a video line. You could go live on a phone line. The phone lines were still up and running. That's what I did. There were special types of equipment there where you could make your phone quality sound more high quality. That's how I was filing. And they never really restricted us from actually covering the event. It was very, very strange. They could have kicked us all out. They knew we were coming in using tourist visas. Obviously, you did not come there on a business visa. They would not want new journalists there. But the journalists, the second wave, and that was what I was part of, we came there on tourist visas. They knew we were there. They let us come. And they were hoping to solve the situation as cleanly as possible. Obviously, it did not end very cleanly at all, and it's still something that the Chinese government really hates to talk about.
You also covered the first Gulf War. Now, how did you deal with the danger, and what was your reaction after your colleague Bob Simon was captured?
Well, I mean, there were some moments. I am not necessarily the type of reporter. I have some colleagues who sort of have that, and this can be male or female, who have that type of intestinal fortitude where they really don't care about the danger. I am not quite as brave as many of my colleagues. I had some moments where I wish I wasn't here right now. In the end, it's all about, you know, your fear of surviving. I mean, if someone could tell me, you're going to be fine, just cover the story. If I knew what the end would be, I would be comfortable with the middle, but not knowing what the end's going to be, there's fear sometimes. Having said that, I was never really in a dangerous situation as it turned out. In my mind, I might have been, but realistically, I never was. That, as you know, was a pretty clean war. We had the air war for a number of days, a number of weeks, that really put a great deal of hurt into Saddam Hussein's supposed, you know, I believe they called it the Republican Army back then. This was sort of an army to be feared. And in the end, the allies, led by Schwarzkopf primarily, were really able to have their way with the Iraqis. The Iraqis made one small incursion into Saudi Arabia, the Battle of Kafji, which I happened to be sent on, and it wasn't much of a battle. The U.S.-led forces were really able to take hold of it. It was a much cleaner war, obviously, than the Second Gulf War, which obviously has ramifications to this day.
One of the issues that I remember of the Gulf War was that supposedly we were there, or the official line was, at the request of Saudi Arabia. And then apparently when our GIs got there, they were asked to take off any Stars of David or crucifix that they were wearing. And then I feel that if I was there and I was going into battle for someone, I'd want my religious medal, if it meant anything to me, to be on. I didn't see much coverage of that. Did you get involved in that story at all?
I didn't get involved with that story. I was aware of situations like this. You know, this was one of those situations where everyone was doing some things that they weren't comfortable with. The Saudis weren't really comfortable having Americans, so many Westerners, especially Western reporters, forget the troops, the Western reporters in their country to begin with. Everyone looked up the other way for some of these issues just for what they felt was the greater good. And I think they allowed the reporters in, even though they didn't want to very much. The military sort of said, okay, we'll go along with this, even though they probably may not have wanted to. Everyone had to sacrifice a bit from what they might have wanted to do in a situation where there were no ramifications. So it was one of those situations where, yeah, these things did happen, but the military, again, may not have liked it, but allowed it to take place.
As I mentioned earlier, my oldest friend, Kevin Buckley, was the Newsweek correspondent in Vietnam during that war, and many of the journalists there, him, David House from Board Just and others, became super critical of not the American soldiers, but of the management of the war itself. Did you find similar reaction among journalists to the first Iraqi war?
This was the war we were, and of course the military was concerned, we don't want another Vietnam where the news media goes wild and reports all our problems. So that's when they came up with the idea of embedding reporters with troops. And you were given some leeway, obviously, if you were in an embed, and you were looked upon, I would say, somewhat in a negative way by the military if you didn't go along with those rules. But there were some people who had successful reporting without following those rules. A lot of the British reporters just went against the system, just went on their own. There was one famous incident of a bunch of photographers going up to the Iraqi border with Saudi Arabia, where the bombarding was taking place during the air war. And they had, and Saddam had put many troops on the border. And many of these guys were very old, in their 30s, 40s. They were almost like Saddam was willing to sacrifice them, we felt. And there was this one very memorable incident where a number of photographers, I know there was a French photographer, I think a couple of English photographers, I'm not sure there were American photographers there. They went up to the border, and the Iraqi soldiers surrendered to them. They did not want to be part of this. They surrendered to the photographers. That gives you an idea of what some of the atmosphere was like there. I don't think the American reporters liked being embedded. I was an embed only once in that quote-unquote famous Battle of Kafji. Except for that, I was sort of like on my own, doing my own thing, venturing out at times, staying in our central location was a place called Dahran, Saudi Arabia. That was, if you remember, the Blue Cabanas. That was our hotel there. if you have a good memory, remember on the morning news when it was nighttime still in Saudi Arabia, but morning in the U.S., you would see some of the blue cabanas in the background. That was the main hotel where NBC, ABC, CBS, and CNN were reporting from during the Gulf War. So that was sort of my base of operations. I would venture out from there. Eventually, I did go to Kuwait when Kuwait was freed, stayed there longer than I was supposed to. I was told I would not be allowed back in Saudi Arabia. We hitched a ride on an American military jet. They just said, we'll bring you back. And I was back in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi that we had not followed our agreement to stay in Kuwait for only a short period of time. But the American military, again, looking the other way, as everyone did in certain instances during the first Gulf War, they flew us back from Kuwait into Saudi Arabia. I was back in the country, did not have to pass through border control, passport control, and I was back in okay.
Just as with Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin, which apparently never happened, there were also rumors that the whole stories of the Iraqis pulling the infants out of the incubators and throwing them out of the hospital was made of whole cloth. Is there a definitive answer to that story, or is it still not known whether it's true or false?
I have heard stories one way or the other, and I've also heard versions of each story one way or the other. The main reason that got people skeptical was supposedly, and I think there's reason to believe this, there was apparently a sign put up in English where it said Iraqi milk factory or something like that. And everyone tries to use the media. The American media, the American military uses the media. And, of course, in that case, the Iraqi military was trying to use the media, trying to suggest that things were happening that didn't. Never have actually heard a definitive answer on that issue, though.
All right. You mentioned politics earlier and covering the Bush campaign and the election. You also covered a number of conventions and confrontations. Will you take us through some of the ones that interest you more?
My favorite one is as a child watching the 1968 convention, but I was a bit too young to cover that. But I've covered every campaign to some degree since 1984. Been at conventions, covered campaigns. Obviously, the 2000 campaign is a legendary campaign because of the election aftermath, not knowing who had won, and actually having, for the first time in my lifetime, although we never thought it would happen a second time, someone who wins the popular vote not winning the electoral vote. We knew it had happened once before. I believe it was Benjamin Harrison, as I recall, won the I'm sorry if I'm wrong, but I think it was Benjamin Harrison won the presidency without winning the popular vote. So we knew it could happen. We all learned in school that could happen. But, you know, we all felt that was sort of a relic of that one instance in the past and would never happen again. So 2000 was a fascinating election, went to the Supreme Court. And then, of course, we've had remarkable elections since then. I thought 2008, just the symbolism of a black man being elected president, the scenes I was able to witness with African Americans, just the emotion that went through their hearts of having Barack Obama elected. There were, I would say, maybe five or six times I would run into a man or a woman. It was mostly women, it seemed. They'd be in like their late 30s, 40s, maybe 50s, and they would say the same thing to me. I wish my mother was here. She never thought this would happen. And that was quite a bit of emotion to see a black man elected president. I will tell you, I never thought it would happen in my lifetime. I thought a woman would be elected first. So that was a landmark election. And then, of course, 2016, you had the first woman with really who was a nominee with a chance to win the presidency up against one of the most unusual candidates we've ever had, Donald Trump, and Donald Trump became President Trump.
One of the great quotes from the 2008 election, I remember, was from Jack Kemp, who conservative, had disagreements, real political disagreements with the Democratic platform, but supposedly when Obama was declared the winner, he turned to his family and said, "Isn't this the great country?"
I know many Republicans who said that. I've maybe not publicly, but there were many, many office holders who understood. Again, they were not for Obama; they were for McCain, but they understood the symbolism of America, a country that had enslaved blacks, enslaved African Americans, had brought them, in some cases, obviously, many cases, brought them over to be slaves from Africa. And of course, this has been an ongoing issue in the U.S. for 150 years, longer, to have the U.S. do something like this, I think was a great moment in American history. And it showed that a country can overcome some of its past, which is an embarrassing past. The years of slavery are something our country is not proud of and should not be proud of. To have someone who was in that group attain the highest office in the land. And remember, there were only how many hundreds of millions of Americans have lived since 1776? I don't know. But there's only been now 45 people who have held that office. To have Barack Obama at that time, only the 44th individual attain that high office was quite remarkable.
Yes. The other type of happening that captures our attention, the natural disasters. I remember Dan Rather first coming to national attention covering the Texas hurricane. Would you take us through some of your experiences with disasters?
Covered many natural disasters. The one that I'm trying to think that sticks out in my mind is because I was actually there when it happened. Sometimes we are what they call firemen. They send us to the scene. So you sometimes have an event that happens, and you are, go there. I happen to be in San Francisco covering the 1989 World Series between the Giants and the Oakland A's at Candlestick Park. I think they still called it Candlestick Park. When that stadium suddenly, just after 5 o'clock local time, the games, I think, began at 5:15. If you've ever seen the videotape on ABC, Al Michaels is on the air. They're doing their pregame show before the World Series, and everything starts shaking. I was in the football press box, the auxiliary press box. I wasn't important enough to be in the main press box. And the football press box was on the rim of the stadium, high on the side, overlooking third base. And I've always claimed, maybe it makes me sound a bit braver, but I claim that press box on the rim of the stadium had to shake more than any other part of the stadium. But it was a very, very long, it seemed like a very long shaking experience. I knew right away what it was, having lived in California. A friend of mine who is a movie director said that, who was there, he said, you could tell people from the West Coast and from the East Coast. The East Coast people were really scared. The West Coast people were concerned, but they knew what it was, and they were dealing with it. And I was one of those West Coast people. I dealt with it. But for a number of seconds, I remember it went on long enough for me to consciously think to myself, is this stadium going to collapse? Ever since then, if you're a baseball fan, you know that Candlestick Park was one of the most derided stadiums in the history of baseball because of the wind conditions. It was not the best located stadium looking back on things. But to me, it's always going to be my favorite stadium because it stood up. It saved around 50,000 lives, including my own. So that's always going to be my favorite stadium.
I saw the football exhibition game there with the 49ers once. Well, of course, you remember the pictures, though, of the of that highway falling down, that bridge falling down.
Yep,
and that was a terrible tragedy. How long were you on that story? Did you see the story through beyond the World Series?
Yeah, no. I mean, what happened was the World Series was delayed, postponed. First time ever you had a World Series in the middle of the series being postponed. And it picked up again, and I never left. You know, I put on my news shoes, which is primarily, that's what I am. I do a number of events when they are at the high level of becoming a news event, and I do enjoy that a lot. I'm a big fan of sports, so I do enjoy that. But, you know, I'm a news guy in a world of sports sometimes, so it was very easy for me to put on my news boots, immediately go to work there, cover the earthquake. And I had covered earthquakes in Southern California before, so I had some idea of how you do this type of story. And then I stayed on when the World Series resumed. I covered it when it resumed, and it lasted only two more games. He swept the Giants four straight.
You also covered the Newtown and the Las Vegas mass killings.
Yeah.
How do you prepare for and then deal with such personal tragedy?
I've covered, sadly, many, many mass shootings. You know, before Newtown, I had covered many of them before. Newtown was the biggest challenge to me because we've never seen a mass shooting where children were the actual targets. We had seen horrible situations where maybe even more children were killed. I am sure. Remember, there was a nursery at the in Oklahoma City when McVeigh and Nichols blew up the federal building there. So I believe there were probably more children killed in Oklahoma City than Newtown, but they were not the targets. These children were, in the end, the targets. And that's what changed that story. Newtown was the only time, and, you know, we are like doctors in a sense. We put up unconscious barriers sometimes. We don't let the stories get to us. I'm not saying all reporters, but many reporters. I'm one of those. I just have never, and I'm not doing it consciously, I've just never allowed stories to get to me. That was one story that got to me. And I remember thinking at one point, am I going to break down on the air? I never did, but I had said to myself, if I do, that's fine. Now, there were a number of times I was doing, because, you know, most of our reports are on tape. There were a number of times I did sort of choke up reading some of the scripts. And, you know, you just don't use those takes. You use the takes where you're a professional reporter reading it like a news reporter reads it. But that was the only story that I can ever recall that hit me so strongly. And it was because of the kids being involved.
On the lighter side, as you mentioned, you've also covered sports, the Olympics, the Super Bowl, the World Series. I remember when CBS had general commentators who were known for their sports knowledge, such as Haywood L. Bruin. Stole his cap once, the last available one at the Chase Stadium after the Mets World Series win in 1969. I had, through luck, wound up in Joan Payson's private club when she owned the Mets after it, and Casey Stengel was there and Pearl Bailey. I was there for hours and drinking on the house.
Wow.
And I went downstairs and there was one cab, and I had to get from Queens to a real section of the Bronx. I get in the cab and the cabbie says, oh no, he says, I'm waiting for Haywood L. Bruin. So I said, no, Haywood has to hitch to hide back in the truck to the studio. He told me to take the cab. So I don't know how he ever got out of there, but I got home. How does a generalist such as yourself rapidly amass the knowledge to cover these activities, the statistics and that? And do you like doing sports?
Yeah, I mean, I like everything. I love covering. I've covered lots of space missions. I live, you know, in Southern California. JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, is very nearby. I've covered many of those missions. Remember the early days of the space shuttle. The space shuttle would land at Edwards Air Force Base. I would cover some of those. I just like everything. I've never really found a story I didn't like. I like sports. I love politics. I love breaking news. I love international politics. Natural disasters. I don't love them, but I love covering them. I just really like all of this, and sports is one of those as well.
Okay. There's a bunch of current questions about the journalism business that I'm particularly interested in. I'm a newspaper junkie, but with Craigslist and the internet eating advertising revenue and newspapers failing or being acquired, and the general population seemingly distrusting the great newspapers such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post as purveyors of fake news, where do newspapers go in the future?
I don't know. There's an irony in all this. Let's talk about a specific story in the New York Times that may have been their lead story today. The New York Times stories are being read now by more people than they've ever been read by. You go back to the heyday of newspapers, let's say the I guess we might say the early 70s, mid 70s, maybe the 60s. Many more people are reading these stories in the New York Times than they read back in the 60s and 70s because they're more available to people. The issue is how to monetize that. And that's the big question. That's the big question. And newspapers are trying to figure that out. Some are succeeding. Some are not. It's very tough. I love newspapers. But even I, a newspaper lover, remember I told you about how when I was a young boy, I would run out to the driveway to get the newspaper. These days, I don't do that because I can read the newspaper the night before on the internet. The only time I buy a newspaper these days, unless I'm at an airport maybe, is as a souvenir for an historic event where I want to have that newspaper as a memento of an event that has taken place.
Well, living in New York, we have two major tabloids, the New York Daily News and the New York Post. And the New York Post, that used to be a liberal rag, has become the right-wing rag with the ownership. And so anytime anything Donald Trump does anything, with the Daily News that was previously owned by a real estate competitor, so taken to absolutely nothing right. If he pulled the child out of the street in front of the car,
right,
him doing political reasons. Now, the New York Post can't say anything bad about him, everything that he does. However, the Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post still have that line between the editorials and the news, but so many people in the country don't trust them. The right wing hates the Times, and the left wing doesn't believe anything in the Wall Street Journal. How do we get these people to understand that responsible papers deliver the news well?
I don't know. It's tough right now because I agree with you. The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, these are great newspapers. Let me move it into a more palatable area of sports. I don't know if you've ever been a fan of a particular sports team. Well, sometimes a sports team has a horrible year, and that newspaper that's covering it is reporting fairly, accurately, fairly what's taking place. But because that team's having a horrible year, the stories all sound negative. And they are, because the team's having a bad year. And I've seen situations where people say, oh, that, no, they really don't. They're just reporting what happens. And I think that's sometimes what we get into in politics. If you are a partisan and a certain newspaper is reporting negative things about your candidate, you will think that that person is biased because you just don't want those negative stories to be there. We all have these human qualities. We all have favorites. We all have teams we want to win. We all want nothing but positive things to be said about that team in a perfect world. So it bothers us if our team is criticized. I think it also bothers people if your candidate is criticized. Now, if you are someone who can take a step back and realize that, a number of years ago, Obama made a mistake, and that's being reported. Now you could say Trump's making a mistake, that's being reported. It's very hard when you're a human being, very much invested, very much wanting that candidate to succeed, very much believing in that candidate, to go along with those stories. So I think that's sort of the foundation of the problems the newspapers are having.
Still relating to that same kind of problem, with the advent of the 24-hour cable news cycles, the liberals only watch MSNBC and conservatives only Fox, and then they see two different universes causing further polarization and hardening of opinion. Is there any solution to this polarization?
Yeah, I don't know. I do see it on Fox. I see it. In my view, I could be totally wrong, a little less on MSNBC, but I see it there. I'll tell you something I happened to see the other night, which I thought was refreshing. Bill Maher, who I think would basically say, yes, he does have a liberal slant, not a big fan of Donald Trump. This was on Friday, and he talked about how, you know what, I'm paraphrasing him very loosely here, so please don't take it literally what I'm saying. But more or less what he said was acknowledge that he's not a fan of Trump, he thinks Trump is off the rails sometimes. They said, you know what? Maybe him being off the rail will make this venture in North Korea succeed. He was comfortable enough suggesting that someone he almost totally disagrees with may behavior and policy as well, but his behavior that Marr probably abhors might actually allow him in this situation to succeed. He wasn't saying it will succeed. He was almost saying, let's have an open mind on this. Let's see what happens. I thought that's the way people should act. I thought that was a responsible reaction, at least the way I read what Bill Maher and felt Bill Maher was saying.
Okay. On top of this, many of our young voters get the majority of their news from social media, primarily
yep.
Facebook and Twitter. And we've seen through the Russian investigation how the platforms can be invaded to disseminate real fake news. How do we deal with this problem?
This is a bigger problem. The fact the younger demographic reads newspapers, but not as much. Watches TV, but not as much. Certainly does not watch the evening news the way I did when I was growing up. Listens to radio, sadly for me, not as much. They get their information from Yahoo headlines, the lead stories. They get their news alerts. They may be more tuned into what's happening right when it happens. In many cases, they're just getting the veneer of the story. And that can be influenced a great deal. Let's say they see some viral video that takes hold. That can really sway people. If it's just a captivating, seductive video that presents a certain point of view. And obviously you have other countries potentially trying to use their influence to get U.S. voters and voters in other countries to act the way they want them to do, even though it may not be their country. So I don't know what the answer is to this, but it's certainly something that we have to be aware of. And again, I know there are people trying to figure out what to do about this. At this point, there's no definitive answer.
I see we have the call on the line, and before bringing him on, let me give you some background on him. He's an old friend of mine, Chick Donahue, who has a book out, The Longest Beer Run in History, because as the merchant seaman, he delivered beer to my old neighborhood, to people from my old neighborhood who were in Vietnam. He never served there in his life as a Marine, but when someone said we got to buy those guys a beer, he wound up going up to do it and actually hitchhiking through places he shouldn't have been and getting caught in the Tet Offensive. Now, I know he just went back to Saigon for the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive, so perhaps he can bring us up to date on what's going on there, and then I'll open him to ask questions of you, Steve, if that's all right
yep.
with you.
Yeah.
Good evening, Mr. Donahue.
Good evening, Mr. McMullen. It's a pleasure.
What can you tell Steve and I about current Saigon and its changes since you were there 50 years ago?
Well, first I'd like to comment on the conversation the two of you were having, particularly about the press and the New York Times and the Post and everything. I think it's great. I think you can read craziness out there. You could read responsible reporting. I think it's fantastic. There's a lot of garbage mixed in with it, but I think to a certain extent it's less censored than it ever was in my lifetime. I mean, I knew what the New York Post was going to write about 30 years ago, and I had an idea of what the news was going to do. And most of the things that I was interested in, the Times never covered. So I can find it everywhere. I gave up on Facebook, by the way. I don't listen to that anymore. That was pure out of your mind craziness. But having said that, I'm glad that they're even debating it. I'm glad that they're discussing it, that it's out there. Something has to stick. And I'm also one of them people who, though I think it's a tragedy with this recent president, I actually pray for him in my morning prayers, that I hope he's successful in doing something good and to protect my nation from the tremendous damage that he's capable of inflicting upon him. But having said that, nothing's changed in Vietnam from what I've seen. Everybody is busy. Everybody seems to have a job. It's poverty. It's poverty. They're all moving, and they're all getting something done. What that is, other than to be moving, and I don't know. But the poverty was bad. Open sewers. The Mekong Delta is like the Harlem River was in 1954 when I was learning how to swim in it. I went back to the embassy the morning of the 50th anniversary to the hour of when I was there when it was being attacked. And a couple of blocks away at the old presidential palace, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of Vietnamese veterans with all of their medals and everything. They had a huge celebration and went on for a couple of days there. And I never thought that would happen. I wasn't anticipating any sort of celebration or demonstration or anything at the embassy, and there was none. I was there by myself at the embassy, and the guards there tried to chase me away. They tried to stop my wife from taking pictures, a girl, an Inwood girl from 212th Street, but she took the pictures anyway. And I said a prayer on a spot where I watched a couple of our young men get killed and watched a bunch of their young men get killed, and recognizing it was a tragedy to all of them. But nothing much has changed there. It was sad. It was really sad. What was nice was that people were walking around and not worrying whether something was going to blow up and kill them. And there wasn't people shooting anybody. And I didn't see any violence of any kind anywhere. But I won't go back. I'm sad. I'm sorry to say that. And as a matter of fact, my wife promised me, don't try to take me back here again.
That's
my report.
That ended your Vietnamese career. Dave, do you have any questions for Chick before I get back to you?
No, I mean, I've heard when I was covering the first Gulf War, there were actually some people who had covered the Vietnam War. I was sort of a newbie to something like this. They were grizzled veterans, and they told me lots of the issues. One of the favorite stories I heard about Vietnam was what I think they called the 5 o'clock follies, which was, I guess, the press briefing every day, I think by the American military. And at some point they lost so much credibility that the reporters nicknamed them the 5 o'clock follies.
Yeah, because, well, I got that from Kevin, from other people, that if you added up all of the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese casualties that were reported by the Americans, there wouldn't have been any people left in Vietnam. They were greatly inflated. What's next for you, Steve?
There was one casualty list that never saw much light of day, and that was on the first day of Tet. There were more Americans killed in Vietnam in that day than any other day in the 10 years of the war.
Wow.
Really?
And yes.
I didn't know that. Steve, what's next for you?
Well, next for me, I know I'm going to be covering something that's going to be a planned event, which I'm really looking forward to, in Memphis in the first week of April. They will be commemorating the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. It will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and I will be in Memphis for some of those events. And I'm going to be like a sponge. I want to talk to people who knew Dr. King. I want to talk to people who marched with him, maybe not famous people, but ordinary people, and talk about what they went through and what they experienced. And what the moment was like for them when Dr. King was killed and the heartbreak it meant for them. So I'm very much looking forward to that. Until then, breaking news. Something will happen, I'm sure, between now and then. That's a month away. So I don't know exactly what's next on my schedule, but that's the one planned event I know ahead.
We've covered the basis tonight in going through your productive life. What else might you like audience to know about Steve Futterman?
Well, I've often joked. I mean, again, I told people before that I've been wanting to do this since, you know, I was like 7 or 8 years old. I sometimes, people say, what would you do if, you know, you weren't doing this? And I say, well, this is sort of, my job is sort of my hobby, which means I like my job a little too much. It also means that I enjoy my job a great deal. So you can like it too much and enjoy it extensively, and it works out just fine. For me, it's been just a fine, fine experience. I've gotten to witness history. That's what I love about the job. It's history, whether it's sports, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a presidential election, even an ordinary presidential election compared to the ones we've had the last few years. It's history, and I love history, and to be able to witness history and be lucky enough to report it hopefully properly, correctly, in a balanced way, it's pretty, I'm pretty lucky.
So we've been from talking to you, Steve. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, John. Sorry I was a bit late.
And Chick, thanks for calling in, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, brother. Good luck to you.
And in a word, the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, for the URL of this show when it goes up and previous shows. Tune in next Sunday discussion. And until then, as you say, the old neighbor, see ya. We'll take it out, Count Basie, hoping to get us to April, get us out of this cold.